the UCR Podcast.
It's always a good day when we get to speak with Steve Hackett, the legendary former guitarist for Genesis, who has been particularly active here in the recent past, releasing 10 studio albums in the last 15 years. But if you look back even further than that, just generally, Steve has continued to make a lot of new music in the years since he left Genesis. Every time I have a conversation with Steve, he's usually already deep into his next album, even as we're talking about the current one. And this particular chat is a bit more retrospective in tone, but as you'll hear at the very end, he does indeed have new music in the developing stages. Can't wait to hear that when it comes to the surface. His most recent release came out earlier this year. It's a pretty fascinating project, the Freya Arctic Jam, a collection of recordings that emerged during a period of jamming in the Arctic Circle. You see, there's always some sort of new music to explore when it comes to Steve Hackett. Steve's next release will be a live album. It's going to be out July 11th, called The Lamb Stands Up, live at the Royal Albert Hall. And for fans here in the States, it does offer a nice preview, if you don't mind the spoilers, of the concerts that he will play here this fall, starting in October. And you can see everything that Steve has going on at his website, HackettSongs.com. It's Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, make sure to follow us so that you will receive new episodes as they are released. And of course, if you dig what you're hearing here, leave us a review wherever you are listening. It all helps out a lot. And don't forget, we have lots and lots of things for you to read about all things Genesis at the Ultimate Classic Rock website. Here's our conversation with the great Steve Hackett. Your tour this year, as always, is a real treat for Genesis fans. You'll be highlighting the Lamb album as well as other highlights from your career. And I wondered, like, how did you approach choosing what you would play from the Lamb?
Well, I just select one of the best tunes. There's 9 tunes that I think are absolutely memorable, which are not dependent on the story or whether you buy into the whole concept of what the Lamb means. So I choose songs that work in isolation, memorable tunes such as the title tracks, such as Fly on Windshield, Carpet Crawls, because people like to sing along with that, Lily White Lilith, because it was a very good tune that was written before The Lamb, actually. Chamber of 32 Doors, which is a bit of a favorite. I think it's a great tune. The Lamia, which again, I think is a beautiful tune in its own right, in a sort of pre-Raphaelite style, not typical of the Lamb at all. It's much more romantic, and it, because it's a sort of rousing send off to the Lamb right at the end of that. But then there are other things that we do as well.
And you've also got Nick DiVirgilio in your band for this tour, an incredible That's musician. Right. For folks that don't know, like, how did you first come to know Nick?
Well, I knew of his involvement with Genesis round about the time of Calling All Stations. But then I think the first time I bumped into him, I saw him when he was working with Cirque du Soleil. And he was both in the background, but then at one point he goes on stage with various things. And I thought he was very, very good. We have toured with him before. He'd stepped in with us once or twice before. So he's one of 3 drummers that I'm working with this year, because the drum stall seems to be a revolving door. I'm looking forward to working with him again. He's marvelous, of course. Got a great voice, personality, and also, of course, with Big Train, you know, there's quite a feature that he has with them.
Yeah, and I mean, he has such a longtime love and knowledge of Genesis music. Like you mentioned, Calling All Stations, but one of the things that I love that he did early on is he played with Kevin Gilbert when Kevin presented a performance of The Lamb at Progfest in Los Angeles back in the 90s. Uh-huh. So, like, just starting there, like, he knows the material from The Lamb very well in that regard.
He probably knows the entire thing better than I do. But as I say, you know, I do selections from it. Because if I did the entire thing, there's not really much time for anything else. And you could say the main focus or feature of my show is to highlight that. But there are so many other things, so many more things to do. both of Genesis and outside of Genesis, of course.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I like that you, the way that you typically do this is that, you know, you will have a selection of stuff from your, you know, solo career as well as the Genesis stuff. I think, you know, it's a night of music that for people, no matter what part of the career that they've enjoyed, or maybe they've taken the whole ride, like there's something there for everybody.
Yeah, I think it's important to make selections that work. In recent years, I did tend to specialize in doing an entire album. I mean, at one point we were doing Foxtrot in its entirety from 1972. Then we were doing Selling England by the Pound. In some places, we were doing both of those albums back to back. But I think in terms of strong albums, for me, I'd rather select or cherry pick across what I think is the best of that stuff from the 70s and beyond, and not be too tied to the idea of, oh, you know, we're going to give you this in its entirety. However, having said that, due to popular demand, I'm going to do the whole of Supper's Ready, because fans are always asking for that. So originally on Foxtrot 1972, I'll be playing the whole of that.
That's fantastic. And, you know, at the time that you did your Genesis Revisited 2 album, you wrote on your website, "I sympathize with Hitchcock's need to remake an earlier film. You talked about how the vision is clearer and so on." If we take that thought and apply it to, as you were talking about, the shows that you've done, the albums that you've revisited, how do you think the Genesis material has, I guess, grown and developed for you personally? Like, what are you able to appreciate about it now that perhaps you didn't recognize at the time when you were doing the work?
Well, I think old material sounds sweeter with the passing of time. I think you forgive it its imperfections and try and change those things when you go to it again. So things that might have been recorded in haste with aspects of timing and tuning, there's no excuse for that these days. If you're going to do a revisit, you might as well straighten out those things. So, you know, when we were young players all piling in, there was one set of priorities. Now, of course, it'll be well to polish these things. It's difficult to say, but, you know, there are times when I've re-recorded some of that stuff and added orchestra, and sometimes done it live with orchestra. So I think when I'm doing that, I'm doing enlargements, and it's the opposite to doing, you know, segues into things. It's not as if you're doing a medley. I tend to do the full thing. If I'm going to do something, I'll usually give them the full tune and possibly extend with other things. I'd like the end of Supper's Ready. I tend to go off on a guitar feature right at the end of it, just because I'm moved to do so. I haven't got to worry about anyone going, "Hey, that's my moment. That's, you know, you know, you can't do that." Well, I can, because I sweated blood to put this stuff together back in the early days, and I can do my version of it. I like to think it's politics free by now, of course. You know, it's no longer trying to please a whole team or founder members. I'm trying to please the audience, which I think is so much more important than those who came up with it in the first place may not be able to see the wood for the trees. It's a very strange thing. I think the true owners of the music are the audience, actually, the ones who've taken it to heart. The writer's pen gets shared, it gets passed around, it gets emptied. Sometimes it gets refilled, but out front, those who really own it are those who've lived it, who've grown up with it, and done the same thing that I did when I was young, listening to the Beatles, the songs that we lived, that we shared, that we made love to, all that stuff. You know, part of your DNA, all of that. And I'm happy to have been part of that for other people.
Yeah. To paraphrase something that you just said, you mentioned Supper's Ready, and it seems like you probably collectively put out a lot of blood working on that track. That seems like that would have been a process.
People brought in separate bits, and To be honest, back in the days when I'd seen King Crimson when they were in their formative stages before they recorded in the Court of the Crimson King, and I'd befriended over time pretty much everybody in the band. And what I found interesting was their ability to segue pieces of music that had nothing to do with each other. They might do Cliff Richard's The Young Ones. The next minute, they've segued into Holst Mars. It wasn't necessarily about the writing. It was the fact that by a system of cues, you could fuse these things together. And I said to Genesis, I think we can do something long form on record. Now, once we put together something's ready from everyone's additional bits, that some stuff was written eyeball to eyeball, but other times everybody brought in their separate ideas and we fused it all together. By the time it was all put together, it came to the crunch. Like, how do we do this live? And I remember having this conversation with Peter Gabriel and the rest of the band, and I said, well, it isn't going to work unless we've got all the bells and whistles. It has to have everything going for it. It has to have the visuals. It has to have the lights. It has to have the mellotron. This is pre-synthesized days for us. Sound effects have to go off. The train doors slamming. As much as we can give it. Otherwise, we're not going to hold their attention. And I remember it was quite a contentious point at the time, but Peter Gabriel absolutely agreed. And so, having suggested that we did a long form piece in the first place, and insisting that we did it with everything, we gave it everything we had. And it's amazing that it still gets voted top of the pops for progressive stuff. It seems to be the favorite of all progressive tracks. I guess, you know, that idea of long form really worked at that point. I'm not sure you can repeat it. So I know that there were times I've been tempted and thought, like, yes, I could do a 20-minute piece. You know, I could do a 30-minute piece. Of course you can. Yes. But, that might be nothing new in classical terms, where people do concertos and symphonies and all the rest, and themes come and go and get recapitulated and all the rest. But with rock, it's something else. You've got to justify it. So yes, I've been involved with lots of conceptual things, but I think that was the first conceptual piece that Genesis did. I think it was both personal and universal. Peter Gabriel's lyrics, in terms of his experience, but everybody's contribution musically. But it's a band composition. That's it. It's five guys all doing what they could at that time. And we were touring, of course. We'd had the luxury on the previous album, Nursery Grind, to take time off, write the album, record it, and then go out. We were touring a lot. There were various things that weren't finished. I flew back from Italy in order to do guitar overdubs right at the end of the thing. So I was given a clear field. Everyone else was going back by road, no sleep all night. So I was the lucky one at that point. But yeah, you know, heady days, all of that. So I'm still touring Italy. I'll still be doing Summer's Ready. Not every year, but I look forward to doing it. It always works.
Ultimately, do you think that fed positively what you all learned doing that long-form conceptual piece into what you did going forward?
Well, I think, you know, I use some of it today. You know, we had this idea, although we didn't couch it in these terms, that the idea of through composition, stuff that was written so much so that even guitar solos and keyboard solos were written. You didn't go off the map. You know, it wasn't going to fall below a certain standard every night. It wasn't jazz. You could argue that there might be more form than spirit if you do that, of course. Yeah, you know, but a blues band can go off and do that kind of stuff. A jazz band can certainly do that. But I think a progressive audience wants recognizable signposts along the way. So thematic driven material. I think that's what drove that, the recapitulation of stuff at the beginning. So you get it right at the end, but done in a much more grandiose style. I can't tell you why it gets voted time and time again at the top of the tree, but it seems to. And I'm amazed because there have been so many wonderful compositions that people have done either with a small four-man team or with orchestra, in the case of Boko Haram, who were a big influence on us. Sad to see the passing of Gary Brooker. I was just starting to get to know him. We were going to hang out when COVID happened. But I wanted to be able to compliment him and say, not only were the songs great, but great orchestrations that accompanied that and concepts that worked so well. I'm thinking of A Salty Dog. I'm thinking of Grand Hotel, the idea of, elaborate narratives where you get the feeling that the band is really going to town. You've got everything. You've got the choir. You've got the mandolins. You've got the Palm Court Orchestra. You've got the symphony. But essentially, it's still rock. So I think what I'm all about really is this idea of breaking down the barrier between what an orchestra can do and what a rock band can do. So, heaven help me, I'm stuck with that one. Yeah, that's really, really it. I can't help it.
I think people are happy you're stuck with that, honestly.
Oh, I hope so. As I say, wonderful moments that I think Genesis managed to pull off, where you felt at times that you were watching and hearing something perhaps bigger than the three or four, five guys on stage. I like that. I mean, funnily enough, before I'd seen a Mellotron used live by King Crimson and the Moody Blues and all of that, I thought, yeah, it's kind of unethical, isn't it, to have an orchestra at the fingertips. But once you've seen it, of course, then your virginity is gone. And it's, yes, okay, I have to subscribe to this. That's it. There's no going back once you've done that. I mean, I also like very rootsy rock and roll. Don't get me wrong. I very much like what was happening in the mid-60s, where you had great guitar workouts being evinced by people from Eric Clapton, Peter Green, Jeff Beck, Jimi Hendrix, Mike Bloomfield, Paul Butterfield, to mention the Americans. It was just such a heady time, and I was kind of in the wings there. By the end of the 1960s, I'd made an album with a band called Quiet World. I hadn't really done any shows. I joined Genesis by the beginning of 71. And then I was to find out, there's that Joni Mitchell thing about finding out that his dreams are lost and grandeur coming true. And I think it's a very good line, one of her best, if not her best. The rite of passage of that. Yeah, I want to be up there doing it. And then when you do that, you find, you've got the responsibility of being everyone else's night out, so it better be bloody good. And never letting yourself off the hook. So we train endlessly to get to that point where you're no longer ashamed of what you do, but you're proud of it. And that doesn't always come instantly, certainly not in my case.
I like that you mentioned like King Crimson, the Moody Blues, Procol Harum, people like Joni Mitchell. Like, I've talked to folks that they just had their head down doing the work. And I appreciate that you were able to remain a music fan and still pay attention to things, even as you were making music yourself. I think that's important.
Oh, I think it's hugely important to be a fan. And I'd rather be a fan than be a guru and say, yes, it's all come from, my own cosmic brain. No way. We stand on the shoulders of giants. And I've mentioned just a few there of people that I spent time in the presence of, or at least their work. Of course, it goes back much further to, you know, the great work of many classical composers that I could mention, and contemporary writers, people from all eras, so that music can therefore become a time machine where you can borrow something from a Baroque period, you can borrow something from blues, not worry too much about a style. I get worried about styles, I must admit. I find that a limitation. What thrilled me most about the Beatles was that I was tripped up a couple of times. I'd be listening to the radio thinking, that's great, wondered who it was, to find out later that was the Beatles. Had no idea by the time they were doing I'm the Walrus. I think nobody had a clue who it was unless they were in the know. It sounded so different to what they'd done before. You know, essentially from something that was a very simple demo to have had something that was so vastly detailed in terms of a sound canvas, straight away you've got that fusion, perhaps before the word was being used, that fusion of what schooled musicians can do and what instinctive musicians can come up with.
What was it like for you getting ready to record The Lamb?
The Lamb was fraught with complication. By then, many of us were married with families or about to become fathers. And we were still trying to employ the philosophy of going away, isolating and coming up with stuff. So yeah, it's a bit like you're temporarily married to the team. But what was so difficult about The Lamb was the fact that we were recording, or trying to, in a former workhouse that was arguably haunted and was frankly dangerous and unsanitary. And then we moved on once that timed out, because Zeppelin had recorded the famous drum sound from the stairwell at Headley Grange. We then moved on to somewhere in Glaspant in Wales, which was a house that was being built. So we went from a place where the ceilings were giving away to a place where there were no ceilings. And again, it was this idea of, you know, are we growing up, or are we just coming out against brick walls with this? So it was the most difficult time imaginable. And also we had this kind of rupture within the band, the band pulling in two different directions. Peter Gabriel's solo career and the band attempting to survive as an intact unit that was going to go from a five-piece to a four-piece to a three-piece after I left the Cross, and to a two-piece, in fact. Yeah, bands could do that sort of thing. But yeah, it was about to start hemorrhaging members. Doesn't mean that the music was diminished. In fact, I think in many cases it concentrated the music and made it more personal, certainly more radical.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you talked about, like, you know, working on, you know, going back, like, Supper's Ready, like you talked about, like, how you and the members were coming in from various points of touring, which was so common during that decade. Bands just were like on the road, off the road briefly to make a record, then back on the road. And as you say, sometimes you were on the road trying to finish something off. But, like, that's kind of what's interesting about The Lamb, is it seems like you all were able to carve out a decent amount of time to go away, you know, the 3 months or whatever that you spent at Headley Grange, you know, kind of in pre-production and stuff like that, you were able to carve out a decent amount of time to work on the record. Was that somewhat unusual?
Yes, it was. It turned into a double album. I mean, first of all,
sure,
we were thinking that, you know, Peter Gabriel was going to leave and he was going to work with William Friedkin, who had the enormous success with The Exorcist, and wanted Pete to write something for him, a screenplay or whatever. So Pete left to do that. And then I think Friedkin freaked and didn't want to bring about the end of the Genesis that he'd enjoyed. And then Pete came back to the band. Over time, it became apparent that he was going to do this one album, and he was going to tour it with us, so he didn't leave us in the lurch. But then we were going to have to find a new singer after that. So, you know, it's this watershed album, and we were auditioning people. Whereas I knew that we had people within the ranks. We had one person in the ranks who could carry this off. But there was a worry that a singing drummer, having had a front man who was dressing up, running around, doing all sorts of things, the idea of having a guy singing behind the kit was an idea that we thought visually this is possibly going to be very difficult. But funnily enough, it was John Anderson. I was there at Phil's first wedding, to Andy, his first wife, and John Anderson was there. I was meeting him for the first time. He said to me, "Well, Phil's got a great voice. Why don't you make Phil the lead singer and get in another instrumentalist?" And I said, "Well, you're absolutely right, and I agree with you," because he'd sung on my first time I ever wrote for Genesis. Phil sang, and Phil also sang on my album, A Voyage of the Acolyte. So I was saying at the time, I think that's the right thing to do, but the others aren't convinced of that strategy. As it happened, Phil at one point got very frustrated and said, "Let me have a go at this particular song." And we started an album without knowing who was going to be the vocalist. And that song turned out to be Squonk.
Yeah, sure.
Trick of the Tail. Squonk was the first thing that we recorded for that album. Phil did such a great job. Tony Stratton Smith poked his head around the corner while we were at Trident of Wardour Street and said, "Well, chaps, looks like you found your singer. Bye." And he left before there was any argument. So in some ways, you know, it looked as if he was in the know that Phil was going to do that. And I think that if Phil had been rejected for any reason, I suspect he might have just decided to go off and join another band, like Lindisfarne, for instance. But luckily, Tony Stratton Smith talked him out of that and talked him into staying with the band, and the rest is history.
This is one of my final things here, and you know, one of the things that fans really enjoyed was when you and Peter got back with Genesis for that show in 1982. What are kind of your memories of that experience?
I was so very proud to be on stage with the guys who had achieved so much, both collectively and individually. I don't think, you know, there were no slouches on that stage. It was a very proud moment indeed. It was very emotional for everybody, I think, even though it poured with rain all night. You know, it was one of those things. It was an unforgettable night. It was incredible. The spirit was high, and I think it was done for all the right reasons. The idea of Womad losing money and Pete very grandly saying, "Oh well, I'll pay the shortfall," except that he didn't have the £250,000 that it apparently had lost. But the idea of forming the band again for a one-off, reforming the team that was, is something that happened. And it was a great feeling to all be shoulder to shoulder again. Yeah.
Do you have a new album taking shape? I really enjoyed the EP earlier this year.
Well, Yes, I'm working on I'm working on new stuff, which sounds better than ever, of course. But then I would say that, wouldn't I? But I do mean it.
That's fantastic. Glad to hear it, Steve. Well, thank you always for the time, and
thank
we'll
you.
Look forward to seeing you on the tour. Have a great one, Steve. Bye bye.
Thank you. We'll be talking to you about. Thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.